Josh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Sunday Mass at New York St. Patrick's Cathedral, and around the world, Catholics offering a special prayer for Pope Francis, the 88-year-old pontiff remaining hospitalized in critical condition after suffering a new respiratory crisis. Concern among current and former military about President Trump's firing of the Joint Chiefs of Staff chair, a Joint Chiefs member, and several senior officers, retired U.S. General George Casey, former chief of the Army and commander of U.S. multinational forces in Iraq.
That's extremely destabilizing at a time that's a lot going on domestically and a lot going on abroad.
This is after the firing of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Elon Musk's new ultimatum ordering all federal employees to justify their jobs by email tomorrow or consider themselves gone. Tomorrow marking 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the White House saying the president's confident he can get a deal to end the war this week. This is ABC News. Renewed concern. Israel's fragile ceasefire with Hamas could fall apart. Negotiations for phase two were set to begin next week. ABC's Ines de la Cotera is at the foreign desk in London.
So six hostages released. They are the last group of living hostages to be released as part of phase one of the ceasefire deal. Israel, meanwhile, delaying the release of the hundreds of Palestinian prisoners that were set to be freed.
Israel saying its prisoners and detainees will not be turned over until Hamas stops humiliating hostages during its handovers. An emergency landing at LAX, a Delta Airlines flight, more than 160 passengers on board, leaving from Los Angeles for Sydney, had to turn around 30 minutes into its trip after smoke was detected in the galley. The airline saying no one was hurt and passengers were rebooked on other flights. The FDA saying the diabetes drugs Wegovy and Ozempic, which are largely used for weight loss, are no longer in shortage. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Every story matters. And the Civic Media Radio Network is celebrating Black History Month by honoring the powerful stories of Wisconsin's own trailblazers. Meet Reggie Jackson, the Milwaukee historian and teacher, travels the state sharing Black history while challenging what you think you already know.
Invited to all these communities around the state. These people don't know much about the African-American experience, so they asked me to come and share some of that with them. To talk about things related to African-American history, race and racism, things of that nature. I've been to over 50 communities around the state of Wisconsin. People like the message that I sent. They think it's credible information. It's been one of the greatest joys of my life, and it's been a great journey. And I've appreciated all of those folks that I work with in all those different communities engaging in conversations about really important things to them.
Listen for more inspiring stories all month long. I'm Terry Barr.
I'm Lisa Hale with WISS News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anytime at the WISS website at WISS.FM.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. We've had lots of gray days here in Wisconsin, and February is when seasonal affective disorder can really hit hard. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Nationwide, up to 6% of the population suffers from seasonal affective disorder. People in northern climates are especially affected. SAD is typically a temporary form of depression triggered by lack of sunlight in the fall and winter months. Dr. Shyla Mergain, clinical psychologist at UW Health, says women and younger people tend to experience higher rates of SAD, with symptoms peaking in January and February.
We can find that we're more sluggish, our mood is lower, and we're not getting that kind of exposure to light that really maintains that healthy circadian rhythm.
Mergain suggests aiming for at least 30 minutes a day of sun exposure or supplementing with light therapy at home using a full-spectrum light bulb. Other strategies include getting daily exercise, maintaining a routine, prioritizing self-care, and supplementing your diet with vitamin D3. People experiencing SAD can feel fatigued, have difficulty concentrating, or notice changes in sleep and a loss of interest in activities and socializing. Dr. Rhonda Randall with United Healthcare says boosting social connections is one big factor.
when people are socially isolated, it does have a significant impact, not only on your emotional and mental well-being, but also on your physical health.
She says in some cases, medication and therapy could be effective, so seek help from a mental health professional if symptoms persist. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A partly sunny sky across the area for today and light winds. Couple of flurries out there as well. Highs reaching the middle 30s. For tonight, clouds will stick around. A little light wintry mix in spots. Lows in the lower 30s. Right now, it's 28.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time as we'll look back at the weekend headlines with our friend and contributor Matt Flynn, an attorney and two-time chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin. Don't miss it.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Fox Valley's home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Kripescast. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. We are powered by Everlight Solar, and here is this week's episode. Hello, folks. Welcome back to another episode of the Kripescast. Today, we are talking with Dr. Larry Pratt. Dr. Pratt, he's a Wisconsin guy. He's from Rhinelander, Go Hodag. Is that what they say in Rhinelander? Go Hodags. If you've never been to Rhinelander, Wisconsin, guys, there is just one of the most beautiful creatures to ever walk this globe. And yes, it's a real creature, the Hodag. You can find the Hodag in the woods of Rhinelander. But I would travel softly and carry a big stick because that thing apparently could be vicious. I don't know. Nice tangent, Charlie. Anyway, back to Dr. Pratt. He went to the University of Wisconsin for his bachelor's. He got his master's from the University of Wisconsin as well. And he is an expert in ocean currents. Why is that important? Because what's going through the currents? Microplastics, ladies and gentlemen. That's what this week's episode is mostly focused on, is microplastics. And the reason I'm focusing on them is because there's a lot of studies out there that say there's so many microplastics in our waterways that they are in all of our brains. And they're in all of our blood, and it's in the air. So it's everywhere. There are some studies that are saying that the microplastics could be what's causing the rise in colon cancer cases amongst younger people. You hear that that cancer is on the rise amongst younger people, and some people are pointing to microplastics as a reason for that. But microplastics, what they do is it's basically like anything you get that is plastic, you know, like whether it's a water bottle or a plastic bag, or we brought this up in the interview, but it's so annoying when you go to the hardware store and you want to buy a wrench, and for whatever reason, it's in plastic. You know, it's like it's a wrench. You know, I got no idea why they're doing it. Like, it's so unnecessary. I think it's probably for some kind of advertising thing so it can hang or whatever. But, you know, there's so much of this single use plastic that it's just a problem, and it's everywhere, and very little of this plastic actually gets recycled. Something like 5% in the United States alone of all the recycling bins you see around, and all the people, you know, if you at home are putting your stuff in the recycle bin, there is a good chance that plastic is indeed not getting recycled, and it's ending up in the oceans. And that's for a whole other podcast that we've actually done, which is on the economics of recycling and just the pure amount of plastic out there. So anyways, I get really into issues like this largely because, you know, I don't think at the end of the day, any of us really want to be controlled by the government or by businesses. And I think a lot of times in politics, people kind of veer toward, I really don't want to be controlled by the government, or I really don't want to be controlled by big business. And that kind of is how you get the Democrat Republican split. But I think what's common in all of us is we don't want to be controlled. And right now, you know, we are kind of being controlled by the plastic industry and by the oil. The oil companies are the ones that make a lot of these plastics. So we are being controlled because I don't think any of us want this stuff in our water. And yet there it is. And a lot of the reason it is because they have done this whole greenwashing campaign saying, hey, you can recycle this stuff. You know, they put the little recycling symbol on these plastic bottles or whatever. But the reality is they just don't get recycled. So anyways, the goal of this podcast is just help to understand how these microplastics are in our oceans, how they're moving, and sort of what we can do about it, what we can ask of our lawmakers in order to get a solution here to help us all out. And with that, ladies and gents, we are going to talk with Dr. Pratt. By the way, I should also mention he's got his PhD from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and MIT. And I got to tell you, it's a very interesting conversation. He's very informative about how just water moves. And these sort of things could help us figure out the best way to get these microplastics out of the water system. And then really the goal for all of us is to figure out how to not put them in to begin with. And that starts with our demand in not purchasing, our lack of demand for single-use plastics, and also just holding our elected people, holding them accountable and just saying like, hey, I don't want this stuff in my water anymore. What can we do? What laws can we do? Not to put unnecessary regulation out there, but at the same time, I don't think all of us need to be paying, you know, the bill of the big plastic manufacturers. You know, we shouldn't be the one paying the price so they can continue to profit off of things we don't need, like plastic wrapping, hard plastic wrap on a wrench. Dear God, that is a hat on the hat. Okay, unnecessary. Anyways, sorry, sometimes I slip onto a soapbox, guys, but it just grinds my gears a bit. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dr. Pratt. Here you go. How's your day going? What you been up to?
Well, I just been getting a little bit of research done. And we had a nice snowfall last night, so I'm kind of enjoying the snow.
Yeah. Where are you based out of now?
So I'm in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, which is located on Cape Cod. But I grew up in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, so I'm used to kind of long winters and, you know, snow that actually sticks. And so here the when it snows in Boston, it tends to rain down here. And when it does snow, the snow is kind of slushy and it doesn't stick. And so I kind of yearn for the days, you know, when I was growing up in Rhinelander and those nice snowfalls.
I know, you know, I was just up there yesterday and they had, or over the weekend, they just got like kind of one of their first big snowfalls of the year. It's kind of late for that, but they had all the snowmobilers out and everything. But they're kind of getting less and less snow now too these days. You know, have you talked to anybody from back in Rhinelander?
Well, I'm in touch with a few high school friends, but I hadn't heard that. That's interesting.
Well, I guess last winter was really bad all across Wisconsin, and this winter's like kind of here and there. But yeah, that is the best snow, isn't it? You know, when you kind of can walk around the woods and you feel like you got a sound blanket all over you. You can't hear anything, you know?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, in the winter, you can cross country ski and get back into some of those areas that are, you know, kind of swampy areas that you'd never go in the summer because they're swampy and they're too mosquito-y. But when you're there in the winter, they're incredibly peaceful.
Yeah. Yeah, right in the bogs. Right. Yeah. Like where, yeah, you can't, you go there, you can get like ankle high and just muck. But in the winter, it's a whole new terrain you can go around. It's very cool.
Yeah.
Before we get too far in, I just want to give people a sense of sort of your history with plastics, with microplastics in particular, and just environmental studies in general. Would you mind just getting everyone up to speed on that?
Sure. Actually, I only started working with microplastics a few years ago, but I've throughout my career, I've studied the ocean circulation from the standpoint of kind of following water, little bits of water as they move around. So it kind of harkens back to the old days when people who wanted to map out ocean currents would put a message in a bottle, throw it in the water, and hope that that bottle would wash up somewhere, you know, and the person would read the message and get back to them and say, well, okay, so this message washed up on a certain date in a certain place. And then you could try to think about the ocean current that might have carried it on that journey.
Was that how people mapped ocean currents back in the day? Was it the message in the bottle thing?
That was one day. And then, you know, through estimations of ship drift, you know, so people like Benjamin Franklin knew a lot about the Gulf Stream just from, you know, from ship logs and kind of figuring out, you know, from the wind and the positions that there must be a strong current there. And he actually drew a sketch of the Gulf Stream, which was amazingly accurate.
Wow. Yeah. It's always crazy when you like think about those dudes back then and what they were able to piece together with like not much of anything but observation, no computers, you know, just all through observation like that. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. Know? Yeah.
Even when you look at those old school calculators with the little beads and everything, you're like, I need AI to tell me how to use this thing. You know,
yeah.
It's kind of crazy that they were able to figure stuff out like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I you can imagine a journey that imagine you just take a very small little parcel of water, of seawater, and you color it somehow, and then you just follow it. And that parcel may start off at the ocean surface. It may make its way up into the polar regions and it might sink, and then it might flow throughout the abyssal ocean and might get into the Antarctic regions. And then, you know, it might go around Antarctica many times. And then eventually it might go into the Pacific Ocean and into the deep Pacific. And it might be, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years before that little piece of water actually gets back to the ocean surface. And
wow.
And so it's a really interesting journey. And I've always been kind of interested in what happens, you know, along that journey. And that's similar to what happened, you know, when you think about the journey that a microplastic particle might take as well.
Yeah. So what, first of all, before we get into the microplastics of it all, was there something about growing up in Rhinelander that got you interested in ocean currents, you know, very far from the ocean, close to the Great Lakes? You got some rivers. And I suppose if you got in the right river, you could make it to the Mississippi and then make it to the ocean and around the world if you really wanted to. But what got you into that?
Yeah, it was partly my parents restricting my television. So that one of the shows that they actually let us watch, you know, was National Geographic. So we got to see those Jacques Cousteau, you know,
oh yeah,
pieces with them scuba diving, and you know, and so that kind of got me interested in the ocean in general. And I suppose that, you know, there were novels and movies like Treasure Island and Mutiny on the Bounty, you know, Tales of the Sea. So the ocean always had a kind of romantic fascination for me. But I didn't really get into it. So, you know, when I was in high school and when I was a senior, I was trying to figure out what to do. I was fairly good at math. And there were some older kids that came back and said, well, if you're good at math and you want to actually get a job, you should go into engineering. So I went to Madison in the
Go Badgers.
Environment.
Me too.
Yeah. So I was in the civil and environmental engineering program. My in-state tuition at my first semester was $200.
Come on.
Yes.
$200.
Really? Uh-huh. 1971.
Holy, 70s was a good time to be alive, I guess.
Yeah, right. I have no idea what it is now, but
it's like 15 grand a year, I think.
Maybe. 15. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. So yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. So, you know, as I went through that engineering school, I was taking classes on kind of on the flow of water, rivers, you know, floods, channels, engineering applications. And I got very interested in kind of just kind of the physics of the flow of water. And that kind of led me into the ocean, because there's a lot of interesting aspects of ocean circulation from the standpoint of basic physics. And so then I, for graduate school, I enrolled in a program that we have with MIT, and I got my graduate degree there, and eventually came to work at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which is where I am now.
Very cool. And what was it sort of, when you talked about like the oceans and everything and getting into that, have you ever done scuba diving?
Yes, actually, there was a class, you could learn to scuba dive in the swimming pool in Madison. And so I did that. And then we all went on a trip down to the Florida Keys, diving on the reefs there.
Cool.
And I remember, and that was kind of my first experience with the ocean. And I remember it was right after the movie Jaws had come out.
Yeah, great timing.
So I was terrified of sharks. I was really scared of sharks, but that whole week we only saw one shark the whole time. So.
Yeah. Isn't that, I went, a friend of mine's a marine biologist down in the Bahamas, and I went down, and she's like kind of rebuilding the reefs down there. So I went down there and did it. And, we went down and, didn't see a shark. And then we got back up there. This was like the first time we went, I was like, oh, I didn't see a shark. She's like, don't worry, they all saw you. And I was like, oh God, you know, that's sort of the shark haven right over there in the Bahamas. Especially we saw this big sea turtle. And if you see a sea turtle, that's like tiger shark snack, you know?
Oh.
So, you know, they're probably around there somewhere, but, anyways, like when I first started scuba diving, that's when I really became aware of like the ocean currents and how bad they can really like mess everything up if you're scuba diving, you know, kind of like Lake Michigan with the riptide, you know, how that can just carry you away so fast. It was sort of like that kind of moment scuba diving. Were you able to like sort of see? I mean, this is going to sound like it's a stupid question. I'm going to ask anyway. Were you able to see the water sort of from a different perspective underwater as it pertains to the currents and everything?
Yeah. So where we were diving, which was on John Pennekamp Park, there weren't really strong tidal currents there, but the waves were, you know, the surge of the waves carrying you back and forth across the reef was definitely noticeable.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'll move you pretty good.
Yeah. But I swim a lot here, and so we have pretty strong tidal currents here where I live in Woods Hole, and you have to take those into consideration when you're swimming. Mostly they're along the shore, you know, so they're not, for the most part, they're not going to take you out into deep water. But you can get in the water and start swimming. You see the shoreline going by, and you're feeling great about yourself. You know, you're making a lot of progress, and then you realize that there's this strong tidal current carrying you, and you have to swim back against that. So
yeah. It's like swimming on a treadmill.
Yeah.
And then real quick back when you saw the shark, did you see it?
Yes.
Okay. What kind of shark was it?
So it was a lemon shark. It was fairly good size. It was maybe 9-10 feet. But the people that were running the boats told us that shark was hanging around all the time, and divers were used to it, and it wasn't dangerous. So I didn't see any great whites or tiger sharks or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait, did they tell you what to do if you see a shark, what you're supposed to do?
They might have told us. I can't remember. I remember when I saw it, I kind of swam away and I found my partner and I kind of pointed, you know, and I made the word shark. And so we kind of swam off in the opposite direction.
Okay. Got it.
But I did, you know, remember in Jaws, at least in the movie, the one, you know, the person that gets away is the person that was actually scuba diving. Richard Dreyfuss.
Yes.
Swims
yes.
down to the bottom, you know, and apparently the shark ignored him.
Yeah. Smart guy.
Yeah.
Smart guy. Right. Yeah. And then he had to do his whole process of coming back up. I forget what it's called, but it's your lungs don't explode, that whole thing.
Right. Yeah.
Anyways, well, that's good. Got a little scuba talk in here. So what got you into then microplastics?
Well, I guess it was kind of a natural extension of what I was already doing. So if you think about the movement of a very small particle, you know, it's going to be carried by ocean currents to a great extent, but it's also doing other things. So it might be buoyant. It might want to float up to the surface, or it might want to sink. It might have lift, you know, the same thing that happens with airplane wings. Mm-hmm. It might drag a little bit of fluid along with it as it's moving. That's an effect called added mass. It might be influenced by the rotation of the Earth. And so there's kind of a complicated set of forces that are acting on this little particle that kind of determine its, you know, its trajectory. And I was particularly interested in cases when certain types of ocean current could cause things to kind of congregate so that things would concentrate in a small area.
Like the Great Ocean Patch?
Well, so that's the example everyone knows about, and that's at the surface. Yeah, the Great Ocean Garbage Patches is a good example. But I was interested in what's happening beneath the surface of the ocean. Are there places where these things can congregate? We would call them attractors. And so we started looking, some of my colleagues and I started looking at very idealized models of very simple types of circulation, say something that might be similar to what you'd find in an ocean eddy. And we found that the microplastics would collect in certain parts, very limited parts of that flow field. You know, sort of the same way that tea leaves, if you have a cup of tea and you're stirring the tea and the tea leaves will gather in the middle of the cup right at the bottom.
Yeah.
So with these circulations, we were finding that the microplastics would gather around a kind of a strange, imagine taking a string with two ends, you tie the two ends together so you have kind of a loop of string. And the microplastics would kind of be attracted to that geometric object, and they'd all gather around this kind of closed loop.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's important if you're looking, if you're going out there and looking for microplastics beneath the surface, you know, if you're sampling and you're not sampling in that string, you might conclude that there aren't any microplastics. Whereas if you happen to make a measurement right where that attractor lies, then there's, you know, tons of microplastics there. And then you might conclude, well, the ocean's saturated with microplastics. So so that was one reason I was interested in it is that this might tell you, you know, where to actually look.
Yeah. And because, I mean, we've, you know, I was reading this article that, you know, saying that there's so much microplastic and nanoplastic out there that it's in like all of our blood and all of our brains, you know, it's in all our bodies. So it's definitely out there. And I guess the question is, where do you see it congregating the most? And is there a possibility of getting it out of the water system?
Yeah, that's one of the $1 million questions, right? So, you know, on one hand, it seems daunting, right? Because the ocean is just so big. It's, you know, it's 7/10 of the Earth's surface, and the average depth is around 2.5 miles. So it's a huge volume. And, you know, thinking about filtering things from that volume, really, really small particles, you know, it almost seems impossible. But people are exploring, you know, nanotechnology, and they're trying to develop filters that can selectively filter out microplastic particles and not filter out other small organisms like, you know, phytoplankton and zooplankton. So that's something that's promising. I think it's probably a long way in the future. But if it's something that can be done, then again, you'd like to know where these plastics are concentrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so where do they concentrate?
Well, so you mentioned the garbage patches, right? So we have these big gyres in the ocean. There's five of them, the big subtropical gyres. There's one in the North Atlantic, one in the South Atlantic. There's one in the Indian Ocean, and there's two in the Pacific. And you find larger concentrations of floating plastics at the centers of these gyres.
And a gyre for
idiots like me would be defined as?
So it's a big flow that swirls around. So the one in the North Atlantic, it swirls around in a clockwise direction.
Okay.
And it's, you know, it's thousands of miles across. If you put a bottle, you know, a message in a bottle and took the time that would circulate around once, that might be like 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So it's a big, slow moving gyre.
Okay.
And the water at the surface tends to move towards the center of that gyre.
This is the Fox Valley's Real News and Great Conversation, WISS.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. Sunday Mass at New York St. Patrick's Cathedral, and around the world, Catholics offering a special prayer for Pope Francis, the 88-year-old pontiff remaining hospitalized in critical condition after suffering a new respiratory crisis. Concern among current and former military about President Trump's firing of the Joint Chiefs of Staff chair, a Joint Chiefs member, and several senior officers, retired U.S. General George Casey, former chief of the Army and commander of U.S. multinational forces in Iraq.
That's extremely destabilizing at a time that's a lot going on domestically and a lot going on abroad.
This is after the firing of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Elon Musk's new ultimatum, ordering all federal employees to justify their jobs by email tomorrow or consider themselves gone. Tomorrow marking 3 years since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the White House saying the president's confident he can get a deal to end the war this week. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Badgers lose in overtime. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college basketball, the number 11th ranked Wisconsin Badgers losing to Oregon 77-73. It ended a 5-game winning streak for the Badgers, who host the Washington Huskies on Tuesday. Head coach Greg Gard.
That's credit to Oregon. We didn't attack the pressure. We got us to walk the ball up and play slower. So we'll learn from this and quickly turn the page for Tuesday night. But again, what got us in trouble was the completely kind of taking our foot off the gas offensively for whatever reason.
Baseball, in the first day of Cactus League action, the Brewers beat the Reds 8-7, thanks to a pair of home runs by infielder Vinny Capra.
I was just focused on the process. You know, I didn't have the greatest BP, and I just said, I'm just going to go on to the game and try and do what I can, and just focus on the ball, focus on the pitcher, and focus on approach, and just kind of do what I can, and it ended up being a good day.
That's the Brewers' Vinny Capra. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A partly sunny sky across the area for today and light winds. A couple of flurries out there as well. Highs reaching the middle 30s for tonight. Clouds will stick around. A little light wintry mix in spots. Lows in the lower 30s.
It's 30 at our studios.
You know, I really enjoy it when anyone else besides me cooks. Truly, I do. And if you feel the same, then the upcoming fundraiser at Christine and Domestic Abuse Services on Friday, February 28th just might interest you. You can taste delicious creations from over 30 chefs, all from the local community. Then vote on your favorite and see who wins Top Chef. If this is an event that interests you, and remember, it's for a good cause, you're going to want to check it out and get your tickets. Or heck, buy a whole table. Go to WISS.FM, click events, and get yours now.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Mississippi has one of the country's worst records for protecting voting rights and advancing democracy reforms. So when pro-voter bills emerge from the state House and Senate, like in-person early voting and the ability to cure a mismatched absentee signature, democracy advocates take notice. Mississippi is one of only three states without some form of in-person early voting, along with Alabama and New Hampshire. The Mississippi Free Press reports that February 12th, the Mississippi Senate passed SB 2654, allowing 15 days of early voting, ending the Saturday before the election at noon. The Republican-sponsored bill passed 39-12, but even if the House advances, it may still be vetoed by Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who accused the bill's sponsor of making the state's elections less secure. The Mississippi House also took some positive steps. HB 1419 prohibits moving or closing a polling place location within 60 days of an election, sometimes used as a voter suppression tactic. HB 163 sets rules for absentee ballots where the signature on file doesn't match the signed outer ballot envelope and would give the voter a chance to cure the problem. And HB 288 would make each county's five election commissioners nonpartisan positions. All three bills now move to the Senate. We have more on these bills and local reporting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
I'm Charlie Behrens. This is Civic Media, and here's my conversation with Lawrence Pratt.
And so anything that's floating gets carried towards the center. But it doesn't actually collect right in the very center. I mean, it will collect in a pretty big region. I mean, something that's about twice the size of Texas.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so you find larger concentrations of floating plastic and microplastics at the surface of those gyres. It's not, Charlie, like you would go out in a boat there and you just see something that looks like a garbage dump.
Right, right.
There might be places where you see floating bottles and so on, but it's not like, it's not like this awful place. It's just more if you actually measure what's out there, you count the number of plastics, you just find greater concentrations there than you do in other parts of the open ocean.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So yeah. A lot of the microplastic in the ocean is going toward these gyres in the various oceans. That's right. On the surface.
Yeah.
What about under the surface?
Yeah, that's a big mystery. So we know that there's, a lot of the heavier plastics, they just sink to the bottom and they get into the sediment, and that's been well measured. Even in the deepest trenches in the ocean, you can find microplastics in the sediment. But there's some plastics that they have a density that's fairly close to seawater, and so they might be just slightly buoyant or just a little bit heavier than the water. And so they can be suspended for long periods of time in the ocean. And those are the ones that I'm interested in. But when you actually go out and look for them, you can find very, very small numbers. And then you can go to another spot where you find really large numbers. So, for example, one survey that I saw took a bunch of water samples at like, I'll say 1,000 meters depth, and they hardly found any microplastics. But then I talked to another team from Japan, and they took some samples from underneath the Kuroshio, which is it's a big current there. And at about the same depth, they were finding like 1,000 particles for every cubic meter. So we just have samples here and there. Very sparse samples, and so we really don't know a lot about the subsurface distributions of microplastics. But we do know that there are certain places where you find a lot of them.
And we should step back and say that how do these microplastics get into the ocean to begin with? Like, what is a microplastic? Where does it come from? And what can people who are interested in just stopping their part in creating more microplastics, what can they do?
Yeah, so a lot of microplastics, first of all, microplastics are small bits of plastic, kind of the largest size that we think of as a microplastic is 5 millimeters, okay? So a millimeter is what? It's about the size of the thickness of your toenail, something like that. So the larger ones we can see, they range in size all the way down to a micron, which is like 1/1000th of a millimeter. So those are ones we can't see. And then you have ones that are even smaller than that. Those are the nanoplastics that you talk about. Those are hard to find. We don't know too much about those. And where do they come from? There's a lot of different sources. So they can come from the disintegration of things like plastic bottles and plastic bags. You think about a bag that blows into a stream or something like that, and then it travels down that stream. It's subject to mechanical stresses from the water and the waves, just being hit by ultraviolet sunlight. And so it can slowly break up into small pieces. Or you can take, you know, like a plastic container. I went to the hardware store the other day and I was looking at tools and I saw there were some wrenches there that were, they came in these plastic containers.
Dude, nothing pisses me off more when you have a pipe wrench wrapped in plastic, you know, like it's a pipe wrench. I think it's going to be fine. You know?
And then you take it home and you try to cut into it with your scissors and it's hard and brittle. And even when you're cutting into it, you're creating a lot of little tiny plastic shards. Those are microplastics.
That's amazing to me. The crap people wrap in plastic. Like I got some knives, like a knife block, and every single knife they individually wrap like the handle in plastic. I get if you wrap the blade, you want to protect it with some, I don't know. I feel like cardboard would be a lot easier than but just the amount of unnecessary plastic stuff that you order. Like you get a shirt and it's in a plastic bag. Why? You know, I don't know. I'm on my soapbox now, but I'm glad you brought that up at the hardware store. Of all things, I don't need wrapped in plastic. It's a friggin' wrench, you know?
Yeah, right. And then there's fabrics. There's, you know, like fleece jackets, you know, and I'm as guilty as anyone at wearing those fleece jackets. They're, you know, they're comfortable. They're great. But they do shed a lot of little microplastic fibers when you put them in the washing machine, and that stuff, you know, it's gonna make it into your municipal wastewater treatment plant, and you know, some of it will get filtered out probably, and some won't, and so it'll end up in a stream and eventually into the ocean.
That's really interesting. I don't think a lot of people know that. So, what kind of clothes would have microplastics in them, and are some clothes worse at shedding microplastics than others?
Yeah, so the plastic is the PET, you probably heard of, which is a type of polyethylene. And so these kind of sweaters or, you know, zip down jackets, a lot of are made from that. And it's polyester. And if you look closely at it, you can see that there's a lot of tiny little fibers there. And that's basically a type of plastic.
That's on all kinds of like is spandex. There's a lot of plastic in the clothes, but do some come off more in the wash? Like if you wash them cold or something, does that help? Is it the heat that releases them, or just they just release all the time?
I think it's probably just the mechanical stress of being in a washing machine being turned around that turns them loose. There was one of the companies that makes these, to their credit, did some experiments where they put one of these things in a washing machine for 24 hours. The reasoning being that that's about the time that an average jacket is going to spend in a washing machine over its lifetime. You know, maybe you wash it once a year or something like that for 12 years. Mm-hmm. So they did that. And then they counted the number of microfibers that got shed from that jacket. And it was in the hundreds of thousands.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So just don't wash your clothes.
Well, that's And then, you know, you probably have to be careful of how to dispose of them, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So you can't, like, they're just a problem anywhere they are. How do you dispose of them? Do you have any ideas on that?
We have, every once in a while in our town, you know, there's a collection of certain types of plastics that you can't just put in our regular recycle. Like, you know, recently there was a styrofoam. You could go to the high school and leave your styrofoam stuff there. And there's also collections like that specifically for fabrics too. So you can be on the lookout for those. If you're wherever you live, if they do that, you can take advantage.
Very interesting. Yeah. I mean, you know, you do as much as you personally can. It's probably not going to stop this is real tragedy of the commons. Like, yeah, maybe I can be looking out for that styrofoam recycling or that fleece jacket recycling. But when most people don't even know that that's what's happening with fleece jackets, you know, you can see real quick Like, what role do you think sort of the companies that are making those things should have in like telling people about that and also kind of cleaning up what has been put out in the environment?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to get too down on the companies. I think it might have been Patagonia that did this experiment, and so that's to their credit, you know. And I think these companies are right now, given the interest, you know, of the health risks of microplastics, are probably thinking about developing new fabrics, maybe fabrics that don't actually shed the microplastics or are based on some other material. But, you know, in general, I think we can do a lot just with trying to avoid single-use plastics, you know.
Oh, like plastic straws?
Plastic straws, plastic cups, those styrofoam plastic cups that, you know, you go down, you know, if you work in an office, you go down to the coffee machine and they have those styrofoam plastic cups. Typically, those things just get thrown away after one use.
Yeah.
Plastic bags, you know, you can reuse plastic bags many, many times.
So eliminate the single-use plastics. That's really good. What about, is there any way to kind of filter out, like, let's say with the washing machine, you know, and you know the way kind of water works and, you know, can the filter go in the washing machine since it's hard to filter once it's in the ocean? You have to worry about all those other things. But is there a filter that you could put in the washing machine itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I have no idea.
You ever think about like inventing one of those things or like how would you even go about doing it? You know, or is that not really in your specialty?
That's not my wheelhouse. But, you know, if there's a lot of inventors out there, you know, I could see developing something like that. And then maybe, you take it on Shark Tank and get some funding for it.
There you go. Yeah. Mark Cuban, throw $1 million for 500% of the company and then sold, you know. What is it in your studying of the microplastics and nanoplastics in the water system? What are you really like? What's kind of your holy grail? What are you really hoping to figure out? What gets you really excited about it?
So I would like to be able to tell people where in the ocean, the whole three-dimensional ocean, where microplastics are collecting.
Because once you know where they're collecting, then you can go get them, I guess.
That's right, yeah. And I'd also like to be able to tell people where the plastics are actually going. That's part of the story, too. So, you know, the estimates of microplastics that are getting into the ocean every year are something like 5 million tons to 12 million tons. So just lots of plastics. But when you go out and you measure or you estimate how much of that stuff is floating at the surface, it's a very small percentage of that. So where is the rest going?
Mm.
And so, you know, there's kind of a budget there. We'd like to figure out, you know, how much is going in, how much is staying in, how much is going, where is it going, how much is washing up on beaches, how much is going into the sediment. Of the stuff that's going into sediment, you know, is it possible that any of that can get resuspended? You know, questions like that.
It's kind of with the ocean being so big, it's how deep is the deepest part of the ocean? Do we know?
So the deepest part is about 10 kilometers, which is about 35,000 feet.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Man.
And they found microplastics down there. So that's in the Challenger Trench, I believe. And so some of those really deep trenches in the Western Pacific, they found microplastics at the bottom of those trenches.
So we know they're getting all the way down there, huh?
Yeah.
And sink. That's crazy. Yeah. What do you think about people who say there's aliens in the ocean? You think we got any motherships down there?
Well, if you can show me some evidence, I'll consider it. I haven't seen any evidence yet.
Okay. I'm just throwing everything at you, just seeing what we can do here.
Yeah.
What is the weirdest thing you've ever found about the ocean?
The weirdest thing, I'm not sure it's the weirdest thing, but the thing that really kind of got my attention is that about half of the oxygen that we breathe actually comes from the ocean.
Really?
Yes.
And how do we get that from the ocean?
So the ocean at the surface has phytoplankton, which are these small organisms that use photosynthesis. And so they're using carbon and they're releasing oxygen just like trees.
Oh, wow.
And as it turns out, quite a bit of oxygen.
Holy smokes. Yeah, I didn't know that either. That's crazy. Yeah. How much impact is climate change having on our oceans right now?
Well, so our oceans, you know, our oceans actually absorb a fair amount of the CO2 that we're pumping into the atmosphere. I'm going to say something around 30%. And that's because carbon dioxide can dissolve in water. And then, you know, that carbon that gets in to the ocean gets used, you know, as part of what we call the carbon cycle. So there's organisms that use it. And sometimes those, and so it becomes part of the food chain. And then those organisms will, you know, they'll die or they'll poop it out and it'll sink down to the bottom and become part of the sediment. So a lot of the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere actually gets into the ocean. And, but the other thing is that actually makes the ocean more acidic.
And then that's when you get when you see those coral bleachings. And so then the coral gets bleached. So like this all is, it's kind of very complicated. It's really not that complicated, but for your average person who's just scrolling on their phone all day, what are like the big things that you think like you should care about this? Why? So the ocean takes in all, it becomes more acidic. The coral reefs get bleached. We hear that happens, but then what does that mean for your average person?
Yeah. So, for your average person that loves coral reefs, that's a big red flag, right? Because a lot of the coral reefs have been bleached. You know, you look at the Great Barrier Reef and that's been bleached. And that's also, you know, a function of the water getting warmer too, which is another consequence of atmospheric warming. And then of course when the water gets more acidic, it makes it harder for shellfish to grow shells. And so, you know, it impacts, you know, the food that we get from the ocean.
So basically it like messes the whole food system up because if shellfish have less hard shells, then I mean that not only impacts our enjoyment of those fish, but it also probably makes that species more susceptible. Couldn't that collapse the whole food chain of the ocean?
Yeah, I mean this is kind of taking me out of my realm, but yeah, that's what, you know, in general that's what people are worried about. Another thing that people could think about is, you know, the effects of sea level rise. And about half of sea level rise is actually just due to the thermal expansion of the ocean. So the water gets warmer and it expands a little bit. That causes sea level to rise. And so there's places in the Pacific that are being lost, you know, beautiful coral atolls that are probably going to be lost within the next 50 years. There's an island nation called Kiribati in the Pacific, which includes Christmas Island and about 30 other atolls. And, you know, the highest elevations of these places are maybe 6, 8, 10 feet above sea level. And so they can't really tolerate much sea level rise. And I've been to these places. I love to go bone fishing. So I've been fishing for bonefish on Christmas Island a bunch of times. And now I kind of have to face the prospect that it might not, you know, might not even be there, you know, by the end of the century. And it's just an incredibly beautiful place. It's got palm trees, you know, and beautiful flats and lots of marine life. And so those places are going away. The government of Kiribati has even purchased land on Fiji, which is a more mountainous island, and you know they're planning for the you know the populations on those islands to eventually move there.
Wow, yeah, that's and then the Maldives, that's another one, right? Where these are like the modern day Atlantises. And well, then so they are already planning on relocating their people because of sea level rise. What about like Florida? You know, you always see the hurricanes picking up intensity. You see more flooding. What does that have to do with climate change and increased ocean temperature?
Yeah, well, of course, the hurricanes kind of feed on heat that they get from the oceans. And so as the oceans warm, you know, the hurricanes could potentially get more powerful. And they can, and it's complicated too. I mean, they might get started at higher latitude than they do now. The hydrological cycle increases as the planet warms, so there's more rainfall, more evaporation, more water cycling through the atmosphere. And so, you know, the expectations is that the hurricanes are going to get stronger. I'm not sure about the numbers. I don't know if the number of hurricanes is going to increase or not. And then you combine that with, you know, with slow sea level rise. And so that's going to impact a lot of coastal areas in places like Florida, or, you know, places like Bangladesh, where there's a lot of people living at, you know, very close to sea level.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the sort of the microplastics of it all, is there something about microplastics that sort of they're sort of toxin sponges, kind of like they absorb toxins? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. And we have a group here at Woods Hole that works on that. So when, you know, when plastics are manufactured, there's a lot of additives that can be introduced, you know, and it might make the plastic softer or harder or give it some color or make it more resistant to UV rays. And there's a huge variety of additives, something like 10,000 that can go into plastics. And about a third of those are associated with some sort of health concern too. So if a plastic, so right from the manufacturing point, you know, there are additives that that could potentially leach out, like if they got into the, if the plastic got into the tissue of a fish or something like that, it might make its way out. But as you say, there's also some evidence that plastics can kind of attract toxins that are already in the environment. And then the same thing can happen. And, you know, that plastic gets ingested by an organism, a fish or something like that. And then that might be harmful to the fish. But I think, you know, we're kind of scratching the surface of these health risks right now. Some of the studies are very worrisome, but there's a lot of research that we still need to do.
Right. But at the end of the day, there's so much plastic in the ocean essentially right now that it's in all of our water, and therefore it's in the air as well. And it's gotten into our bloodstream. It's gotten into our brains have plastic in them. It's in all of our bodies. And is there anything people can do can they put a water filter in? Is there something they can do for their individual water intake to help in the near term while, you know, hopefully science catches up with getting these microplastics out of the water system?
Yeah. So I don't know what's out there in terms of water filters. You know, certainly the filters that are in everyday use are going to filter out the larger microplastics, but the really small ones, which are the ones we know less about and the ones we kind of worry the most about, might not get filtered out. So, you know, are there developments in industry right now to try to to make filters that can get out the very smallest ones? I'm not sure. That's a good question. But yeah, the best thing to do is to get them right at the source, right? Mm-hmm. Not wait till they're in your river or end up in your ocean where it's really hard to filter them out.
Yeah, and the source, I mean, it's a very small percentage of plastic that actually ends up getting recycled. You know, you see the sort of recycling label on a plastic bottle. I think only 3% of plastic in the United States.
Well, that's all the time we have for now. But if you want to listen to my full Cripescast, check out the Cripescast anywhere you get your podcasts.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you gotta keep her moving.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for Matt and Air on Air.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, the U.S. Supreme Court prevents Trump from firing the head of a watchdog agency. Also, are we headed to a market correction? Plus, who are the leaders standing up for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
Ready.
While the teams get ready to choose their top draft pick, you can help Mino and the Mayor choose their top craft pick.
Northeast Wisconsin is home to amazing breweries, wineries, cideries, and distilleries, and we need your help picking the best.
We've drafted 10 of our favorites, but which local craft beverage creator will go to number one? That's up to you. Mino and the Mayor's top craft pick, drafting Northeast Wisconsin's finest one sip at a time. Details coming soon. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at Civic Media. This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The Vatican reporting that a blood test of Pope Francis shows early kidney failure, but he's alert and well-oriented. The 88-year-old pontiff suffering a new respiratory crisis this weekend remains in critical condition. On the eve of the third anniversary of the start of the war with Russia, Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky saying he's prepared to consider giving up his post to achieve peace and get Ukraine into NATO. It follows President Trump's calling Zelensky a dictator and blaming Ukraine for starting the war with Russia. New York Congressman Mike Lawler, Republican on the Foreign Affairs Committee, telling ABC's This Week he does not agree with Trump's rhetoric.
Vladimir Putin is a vile dictator and thug, and he is clearly responsible for the war in Ukraine.
German opposition leader Friedrich Merz's conservatives on track for a far-right victory in Germany's elections. Chancellor Olaf Scholz conceded defeat. This is ABC News. As Luigi